The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I want to thank everyone for showing up at 9:30 on Sunday morning, particularly those of you under the age of 35. We're probably still hungover. When the comrades who organized socialism asked me to give this talk, they wanted me to try to talk about common left misperceptions of both Roosevelt's New Deal and the U.S. Communist Party's Popular Front strategy in the 1930s and 40s. And it's clear that one's analysis of the wave of reforms, the National Labor Relations Act, the Fair Labor Standards Act, the Social Security Act, that's come to be known as the New Deal, and the growth of the Communist Party as it's pursued its strategic alliance with the so-called liberal labor wing of the Democratic Party and the center leadership of the Congress of Industrial Organizations are closely related. However, I decided that I want to focus on the Communist Party and their Popular Front strategy. Most of us here today, not only comrades in the ISO, but I think many comrades who are joining DSA, particularly the folks who would come to this conference, have a basic understanding of the origins and limits of the New Deal. There's a common sense among many comrades on the new socialist left that Roosevelt was primarily interested in stabilizing capitalism economically and politically, and was probably initially indifferent, if not hostile, to pro-working class reforms, and that the reforms that were won as a result of tumultuous, disruptive, illegal struggles of unemployed workers and industrial workers in the early to mid-1930s. And there's also thinking of a consensus that the New Deal reforms were implemented in such a way as to derail working class militancy into legal and bureaucratic channels. Unfortunately, from my perspective, there is no consensus on the Communist Party's Popular Front strategy. If anything, many on the new socialist left see the Popular Front as the model for socialist organizing in the current period. Last summer, the co-chairs of Democratic Socialists of America, Joseph Schwartz and Bhaskar Sunkara, published an article in Jacobin defending the Popular Front. They claimed, while recognizing the dark side of the Popular Front, the CP's tendency to subordinate its politics to liberalism, their uncritical support for the Stalinist dictatorship, the no-strike pledge, etc., Sunkara and Schwartz still argued that the Popular Front allowed the Communist Party to, quote, become the tribunes for socialism and the best organizers. Again, in quoting them, the Popular Front was the last time socialism had any mass presence in the United States, in part because, in its own way, the communists were rooted their struggles for democracy within U.S. political culture while trying to build a truly multiracial working class movement. I believe this rests on an incredibly superficial and idealized history of the actual practice of the Communist Party and the actual impact of the adaptation of the Popular Front strategy in the 1930s and 40s. It's true that the Communist Party appeared to have mass influence in the late 1930s and early 1940s. During the Second World War, it reached a membership of 100,000, rivaling the Debsian Socialist Party. They led a number of important CIO unions, civil rights organizations, popular organizations, and for many on the academic and political left today, they had an amazing presence in the U.S. popular culture. I mean, if you watch really old movies from the 40s, a fair number of classic films were made by members of the Communist Party. They had a tremendous influence in television, popular music, etc. However, a more careful examination of the historical record shows that the Communist Party had its greatest impact on social struggles and U.S. politics, I would argue, before it adapted the Popular Front strategy in late 1936. The Popular Front alliance with liberal Democrats, the CIO leadership, and middle-class leaders of the African-American movement actually reduced the Communist Party's influence among the most militant minority of workers and racialized people of color. Communists helped the forces of official reformism, the labor bureaucrats, the liberals, etc., to derail the militant struggles in the late 30s and 40s, and facilitating the historic shift to the right in U.S. politics during and after the Second World War. Now, just to be very clear, I'm not arguing that a revolutionary breakthrough to socialism was on the agenda at any point in the United States in the 1930s and 40s. Our forebearers, neither in the Workers' Party or in the Socialist Workers' Party, believed that revolution was imminent in the United States. You read Teamster Rebellion, there were some new CLA Communist League members who thought they could seize power in Minneapolis, and the more experienced people said, no, we don't want to end up doing the Minneapolis Commune. However, in that era, the mass struggles of industrial workers, women, African Americans, opened the three historic possibilities. The first was for the development of a militant industrial workers' movement, with strong independent shop floor organization that could have organized the South and the growing clerical workforce, radically reducing racial and gender divisions in the U.S. working class. The second possibility, that these struggles opened the space, both in 1936 and again in 1944, for the launching of a mass independent labor or social democratic party in the United States. And finally, the turbulent years, I believe, opened the possibility for a mass revolutionary socialist current rooted in the working class in the US. None of these possibilities were realized. In the place of militant industrial unions capable of building class unity, we see the consolidation of bureaucratic business unionism in the CIO and the deepening of racial and gender divisions in the working class. Instead of a mass labor party, the labor movement and every subsequent social movement was tied to the Democratic Party. And finally, rather than a mass socialist current in the working class, we are burdened with the historic divorce of socialist politics from the U.S. working class. It would be unrealistic to claim that a relatively small group whose working class core never exceeded 20,000 members. I know that sounds amazing to all of us in this room, but in terms of a working class of several tens of millions, this was still pretty small. That group alone had the weight to prevent the bureaucratization of the CIO, the subordination of labor to the Democratic Party, or the post-World War II witch hunt. However, the Communist Party's historic shift to the Popular Front strategy facilitated these processes, removing a crucial obstacle to the emerging CIO bureaucracy's drive to recast the labor movement in its own image. The CP's adaptation of a more realistic and practical politics of the Popular Front undermined popular radicalism and power in the US. The late 30s saw the end of industrial militancy, and with it, the impetus for the capitalist state to continue granting concessions to working people. The Second New Deal of the Fair Labor Standards Act, etc., came to an abrupt halt in 1938-39, never to be resumed. And while the CP's membership reached an all-time high during the Second World War, U.S. politics began a decided shift to the right, culminating in the purge of all radicals and socialists in the workers' movement. To understand the character and impact of the Popular Front, we need to locate the evolution of the Communist Party in the United States. Again, unlike the German, Italian, or French parties, the CP was in the US was never truly a mass party with hundreds of thousands of working class members. However, by the late 1920s, the CP had built a small but active membership among first and second generation immigrant workers in the needle trades, coal and iron mining, steel, automobile, and machine making industries. Communist workers played central roles in unsuccessful rank and file reform movements, in the bureaucratized AFL unions, including the International Lady Garment Workers Union and the United Mine Workers. CP members and sympathizers also try to create independent unions in unorganized industries, particularly the auto industry. To facilitate this work, the party promoted the Trade Union Educational League, which is an talk going on at the moment about, which convinced thousands of non-CP worker activists to build democratic and militant industrial unions, fight the AFL officials, and advocate for an independent labor party. The TUEL was the Americanized version of the Comintern's United Front strategy, which rested on the belief that working class radicalism grew out of militant mass struggles against the employers and the state. Only through direct confrontation with capital in the workplace and the streets do workers develop the power to win better wages and working conditions, force state policies that benefit workers and the oppressed, and these struggles often also open more broader and broader layers of the working class to anti-capitalist ideas, while demonstrating that the forces of official reformism, professional politicians, the trade union bureaucrats, can not actually lead successful struggles for reforms. For many on the left, the Popular Front was simply an elaboration of the earlier United Front policy for the epoch of anti-fascist struggles. However, there were fundamental differences. The Communist Front call for a United Front sought to unite working class organizations, Communist and Social Democratic parties, trade unions, organizations of women and racialized minorities, in common struggles against capital and the state. Within the United Front, Communists maintained their political independence to both educate for revolutionary socialism and, even more importantly, to present alternative strategies and tactics in the concrete struggles to that of official reformism. The Popular Front involved a different set of strategic alliances with liberal democratic capitalists, with middle class liberals, and with the trade union officialdom that profoundly limited the independence of revolutionaries. Now, in the late 1920s, the Comintern, dominated by the new ruling class in the Soviet Union, abandoned the United Front with tragic consequences. The Stalinist leaders of the Comintern argued that the 1928-29 depression began the third period of capitalism since the end of the First World War. Very simply, they believed capitalism was about to collapse. Fascism was and social democracy, which they equated as the same phenomena, with the last gasp of the capitalist class, that they would take, that fascism would take power, collapse quickly, and as one moron in the German Communist Party, after Hitler, us. Unfortunately, after Hitler, it was the camps. Now, the third period politics had absolutely tragic impact in Germany. It led to the destruction of the oldest and largest and best organized workers' movement on the planet, its destruction without any sustained resistance. Now, the third period had a more ambiguous impact on the CP's politics in the US, and I'm going to try to be brief because I could otherwise go on in lots of details. Within areas like the trade unions, where the trade union officialdom was still a force, the third period was a disaster. The CP shuts down the Trade Union Educational League and creates something called the Trade Union Unity League, which was basically, to join these unions, you had to accept not only the struggle against the boss, but the proletarian dictatorship. You had to be basically a CP supporter or sympathizer. These red this sectarianism had meant that the Communist Party was isolated from the militant minority of workers who were not yet already revolutionaries. It had tragic effects in several industries. In the steel industry, the sizable communist fraction refused to participate in the growing rank and file movement within the existing AFL unions in 33, 34, where thousands of workers were agitating for strikes. Their maintenance of their own red union meant they were isolated from this movement, and there was no significant layer of radical activists who could provide an alternative to the AFL leadership saying, let's rely on mediation by the Roosevelt administration, all of which derailed this first promising wave in 33 of strike activity in steel. Todd, who's sitting in the audience, wrote a great piece in 2012 in the ISR outlining exactly how this Communist Party's maritime fraction on the West Coast, carrying out similar activity, basically isolated themselves from the best and most militant trade unionists and allowed for the consolidation of a racist syndicalist leadership in the Sailors Union of the Pacific. Now, in areas where the labor officialdom was absent, the CP did do some very important work during the third period. This was most important in the unemployed councils of the 1930s, where the CP in almost every major industrial city around the throughout the U.S., including in the South, for the first time, built multiracial organizations of workers that demanded unemployment insurance, that confronted the police in evictions, that would sit in at welfare offices, etc. This movement organized workers across racial, gender, and ethnic lines, recruited new layers of working class cadres to socialist politics, and gave working people in this country their first taste of a successful struggle since the defeat of the 1919 steel strike. Now, in the wake of Hitler's seizure of power in January of 1933, the communist movement internationally, for a good year, maintained the perspective that Hitler's regime was going to be short-lived and the Communist Party of Germany would come to power shortly. By late 33, early 34, it was clear to everyone that it wasn't going to happen. Hitler's regime was being stabilized. Their previous and this created, I think, a short-term crisis for the communist movement internationally, and it certainly did in the U.S. Their previous strategy had failed abysmally, but given that at this point they were incapable of having an open democratic discussion of past errors, the world and U.S. communist movement entered a period of political experimentation. Across the world, I'd argue, communist parties returned very pragmatically to the politics of the United Front, building common struggles with social democratic workers in their organizations while agitating for action independent of the reformist leaders of the unions and social democratic parties. It is in this period, between early 1934 and late 1936, that Communist Party worker militants in the United States, in an informal united front with left socialists, Trotskyists, the remnants of the IWW, played a crucial role in the wave of mass strikes that establishes the CIO in mass production industries. In early 34, the Communist Party abandons its policy of boycotting the growing federal unions, federal locals, which is what the AFL was trying to push all these industrial workers into. Alongside other radicals, they basically built rank and file movements and networks in these unions that agitated for democratic industrial unions capable of taking industry-wide strike action independently of the AFL leaders or their erstwhile allies in the Roosevelt administration. The first fruits of their success could be seen in West Coast Longshore, where Communist Party militants, recruiting a group of ex-Wobblies, including Harry Bridges, built what was essentially a caucus and network in the moribund International Longshoremen's Association, rebuilt workplace power, and carried out one of the three successful mass strikes, turned into citywide general strikes in 1934. Then the San Francisco general strike, which was part of shutting down the entire Pacific Coast docks. Together with the Minneapolis Teamster strike, which was led by our comrades of the Communist League, and the Toledo Autolite strike, which was led by the Mustyite American Workers Party that later fused with the Communist League, the San Francisco Longshore strike set the stage for the rapid growth of what becomes the CIO. Now, in auto, rubber, maritime, electrical appliances, and machine making industries, the CP, along with other radical and revolutionary workers, led similar rank and file movements in the AFL federal unions to create new industrial unions. And I would argue that the CP's presence in building this new militant minority within the AFL federal locals was crucial to the success of the CIO. While AFL bureaucrats easily derailed the mass strike agitation during 1933, the CP and other radicals were able to provide an alternative, effective leadership after 1934. Their greatest success, their best study success, was in the automobile industry. Together with other radicals, communist workers like Wyndham Mortimer and Robert Travis, agitated against the AFL leadership's reliance on federal mediation and demanded democratic organization of the new federal locals. This powerful movement, which coalesced into what was known as the Progressive Caucus, led unauthorized strikes against individual plants and small producers in the auto industry between 1934 and 36. The most important of these battles was the Toledo Chevrolet strike in May-June of 35, where an elected committee of communists, Trotskyists, and shop floor militants resisted the AFL bureaucrats' attempt to accept federal mediation, end the strike, and return to work without union recognition. The partial victory at the Toledo Chevy complex set the stage for the creation of the United Automobile Workers, initially an AFL affiliate. At its August 1935 convention, the UAW remained under the control of a guy named Dillon, a corrupt and ineffectual AFL official. By the second convention in April of 1936, the progressives threw Dillon out, elected a new militant leadership, and affiliated with the newly created CIO. The height of the CIO strike wave of 1935 through early 1937 also saw, in some ways, the beginnings of a practical schism between the labor movement and the Roosevelt administration. The failure of the NIRA strike wave of 33 and early 34, was the result of the AFL officialdom's reliance on the Roosevelt administration and federal mediation. The victories of 34 to 36 were, to a significant extent, the result of the CP and other radicals' ability to convince strikers to refuse to end strikes, sit-ins, and other forms of direct action in favor of empty promises from federal mediators. This practical break with the Democratic Party found expression in literally dozens of Labor Party experiments at the local and state level. The high point of the Labor Party agitation of the 1930s came in 1936. And both at the UAW convention in 36 and at the Rubber Workers Convention, which I've been studying, there were significant minorities of delegates, something like 30 to 40% of the delegates, who came in supporting a call for a farm labor party in 1936 that would at least run independent congressional candidates. In the UAW convention, they actually won a majority. They won the UAW to the position of launching a farm labor party nationally in the US. And it was only the intervention of John L. Lewis and his lieutenants, basically threatening to cut off funding from the newly formed CIO, that led them to accept, to basically junk this and to join what was known as Labor's Nonpartisan League, which basically cemented the new CIO to the Democratic Party and the CIO. Now, the 7th World Congress of the Comintern in 1935 brought to the end the brief period of the Communist Party's pragmatic United Front activism. The new orientation was not driven by the needs of the class struggle, but by the desire of the Stalinist ruling class in the Soviet Union to cement diplomatic and military alliances with the so-called democratic imperialists, US, France, and Great Britain, against the fascist imperialists, Germany, Italy, and Japan. To secure this broad alliance, the Communist parties were instructed to give up independent propaganda for revolutionary socialism, and more importantly, any open criticism of the labor officials or their democratic capitalist allies. The new orientation of the Communist parties derailed revolutionary workers' movements in France and particularly Spain, and I would argue ended the radical potential of the mid-30s working class struggles in the United States. Now, the impact of the Popular Front strategy was first evident in the CP's role in electoral politics. Again, and here we see the CP playing a very important role in all the industrial unions blocking Labor Party agitation in 36. They also play a very big role in undermining local Labor Party experiments. Their model was the New York State, New York State American Labor Party, rather than creating a truly independent Labor Party, they created a second ballot line for the Democrats. Its main goal, this was initiated not only by the CP, but by the needle trades bureaucrats, Dubinsky of the Lady Garments Workers and Hillman of the Male Garment Worker Unions, in order to convince mostly Yiddish-speaking socialist workers who would never vote for a capitalist party that it was okay to vote for Roosevelt. Okay? All right. The Popular Front also, very briefly, radically, and I'll go into this more in discussions, radically altered the CP stance towards U.S. imperialism. It led to an abandonment in Puerto Rico of an alliance with the Nationalist Party of Pedro Albizu Campos and support for the pro-statehood affiliate of the Democratic Party. It also led to dropping almost all criticisms of the Roosevelt administration's policies in Latin America generally. It was a critical support to the good neighbor policy, which did end, got the most virulent forms of gunboat diplomacy in Latin America, but still meant support for vicious dictators like Anastasio Somoza in Nicaragua, who Roosevelt described quite openly as, yes, he's a bastard, but he's our he's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. Now, the Popular Front also had big impacts on their practical activity in the U.S., both among African Americans and more broadly among the multiracial industrial working class. The initial break with the third period politics led communist parties in both the North and South to seek united actions around concrete issues with other forces in the black community, including middle class elements from the NAACP and the black churches. However, the CP continued to try to organize African American workers and intellectuals independently of the black bourgeoisie through the League of Negro Struggle, which mobilized massive demonstrations in black communities north and south in support of the Scottsboro Boys, against Jim Crow and disenfranchisement, against lynching, and even in support of the Ethiopian resistance to the Italian invasion in 1935. The Popular Front brings a new orientation. Basically now, the CP sees the black preachers, the black liberals, etc., not as erstwhile allies in the struggle against racism, but as the natural leaders of the black community. It leads them to, in Harlem, as Mark Nason points out very clearly in his book, a long-term alliance with Adam Clayton Powell Jr., who becomes the head of the Democratic machine in Harlem. In Alabama, it leads to a tremendous shift. In Alabama, when the CP starts organizing there, and if you want lots of detail, read Robin Kelly's first book, Hammer and Hoe. The CP sends militants down there, and they organize sharecroppers unions. They organize agitation for the right to vote against Jim Crow. And they start, by 34, 35, building and the outposts of industrial unionism in cities like Birmingham, etc. Excuse me. However, the shift to the Popular Front had a huge impact. In the words of the veteran Alabama communist Hosea Hudson, everybody got sucked up into the union, as did their northern second-generation European immigrant worker counterparts. Many black communists in Alabama left the CP when they became labor officials, because, in the words of Robin Kelly, quote, the CIO, in their opinion, offered much better opportunities for personal and community advancement. The Alabama CP's integration into CIO officialdom led them to discourage direct action and militancy among workers and farmers in the South. By late 38, they were discouraging strikes by the unemployed, by workers, etc. In order to, in Kelly's word, to ensure harmonious relations with organized labor, i.e. the CIO leadership, Southern liberals, and the middle classes, they ended up discouraging workplace and community militancy and soft-pedaled issues of racism and racist violence. It's in the main CIO unions this had the most negative impact. And we can see the first indication of this during the Great Flint Sit-Down Strike. The Flint Sit-Down Strike was led by a coalition of radicals. Communist Party had influence. So did what's called the Communist Party Opposition, the group that Lovestone read. But probably the best rooted group in Flint were members of something of the left, of the local Socialist Party, all of whom were allied with what was known as the Socialist Appeal Group, the Trotskyists, who were working in the SP at that point. If you've ever seen the movie With Babies and Banners, that incredibly articulate woman who led the Women's Auxiliary Brigade, Janora Johnson Dollinger, was a Trotskyist. She was a member of the Socialist Party, founding member of the Socialist Workers' Party, and only gets expelled in 53. We can talk about that later. Okay? In the midst of the sit-down strike, which begins in late December of 36, the Communist Party, allied with Lewis, wants to reach an agreement with GM to abandon the plants without recognition of the UAW. And it's only the intervention of other radicals, particularly the left SPers, and coming up with a plan to basically shift the focus of the sit-down to the plant where they made all the auto bodies, where they actually had the dyes that made the auto bodies, which if they had attempted to retake that plant by force, GM would have not produced a new model car for 10 years, that actually prevented the defeat of what was the turning point for the CIO. By early 37, we can see the CP and auto actively derailing sit-down movements, particularly at Chrysler. The limits of the populist front strategy in the late 30s was most evident in the Communist Party's role in the disastrous Little Steel Strike of 1937. Rather than building independent rank-and-file organizations at the independent steel companies, the CP instead signed up as staff organizers for the steel workers' organizing committees. Like the old AFL federal unions, SWOC allowed no membership control over policy, strategy, and tactics. Philip Murray, who had a former miner, John L. Lewis's lieutenant, and would go on to replace Lewis as the head of the CIO during the war, alone dictated the direction of the entire organizing campaign, and the CP staffers functioned essentially as his loyal troops. As many of us who may have had an experience as union organizers know, that the union bureaucrats are your boss, and you don't do what they say, you're looking for another job. The CP gladly went along with this. Murray called a conventional strike that stayed within the boundaries of legality, obeying every anti-picketing injunction, eschewing sit-downs and plant occupations, and instead relying on the newly created National Relations Board and the Roosevelt administration to secure recognition. The strike was crushed through police and National Guard repression, unleashed by Democratic New Deal governors in Pennsylvania and Ohio, culminating in the Memorial Day massacre in Chicago, where the Democratic-controlled Chicago police force murdered unarmed strikers and their supporters who were holding a picnic somewhere on the South Side, probably not far from here. I don't know Chicago that well. I'm very much a provincial New Yorker. When Roosevelt declared a plague on both your houses in the wake of the police riot in Chicago, the strike was crushed. The CP, having abandoned any pretense of independence in their popular front's center-left coalition strategy with Murray, never challenged his legalistic strategy until the strike had been essentially defeated, when CP staffers flipped over and basically were involved in a number of individual acts of sabotage. I forget the name of the author, The Last Great Strike on the Steel Strike gives a really good detail of that. Now, how much time? 2 minutes. All right. I'm going to have to be very quick. By 1937, 38, 39, the CP has increasingly formal influence in the big CIO unions. However, its base among the rank and file disintegrates. Part of the deal of the long-term alliance with Lewis, Murray, Hillman, etc., was to dissolve party fractions in these industrial unions, which meant that rank-and-file communists had no way of holding accountable their comrades who had taken union office. Now, 1939, Stalin signs the Hitler-Stalin Pact. There's a short-term shift towards militancy and anti-war politics, but by the summer of 1941, with Hitler's invasion of Russia, the Communist Party shifts back to a historic alliance. And it's during the Second World War that the Communist Party's politics facilitates the massive bureaucratization of the CIO unions. I can't go into this in detail, talk more about it, but I strongly recommend to each and every one of you, if you want to get a taste of what happened, why the Second World War is the turning point, read a book by a former comrade of ours named Nelson Lichtenstein called Labor's War at Home. He wrote it when he was still a member of the International Socialists. And it's the war years where the bureaucracy of the CIO, allied with the Roosevelt administration and the state, essentially creates the modern structures of bureaucratic unionism. In particular, the abandonment of direct shop floor actions around grievances for the bureaucratic grievance procedure. Now, that struggle to implement that, to impose that on industrial workers, required the bureaucracy to become the cops on the shop floor during the war, to smash every single attempt by workers to defend themselves against speed up, against declining wages, deteriorating working conditions, etc. And in that struggle, the Communist Party were the enthusiastic assistance to the CIO bureaucracy. By the end of the war, who was left and who was right in the CIO was a jumble. Because at points, people who were quite socially and politically conservative but were willing to take strike action were much more militant in confrontation with capital than supposedly progressive union leaders in the Communist Party. For better or worse, our comrades who had right before the war divided over the question of which side they would have taken in the war between the Soviet Union and Germany and the imperialist powers, while an important question, I'm not sure, it did not impact their policies on the no-strike pledge in the Second World War, were divided into two small groups. Despite that, they played very important roles in the movements against the no-strike pledge, particularly in the United Automobile Workers, and I'm finding of significant evidence that they played a very important role in the rubber workers as well. These initiatives, though, were smashed. There were never more than 1,000 or 1,500 Trotskyist labor militants during the Second World War between the two organizations. I'll wrap up. Essentially, the Communist Party plays a huge role in the rapid bureaucratization of the unions, which allows, in the post-war strike wage, which is very large and very widespread, allows the CIO leadership to keep that strike wave completely within legalistic frameworks. There's no picket line violence, there's no sit-ins, there's no confrontations with the cops, etc. There are long, what becomes the sort of model of conventional strikes from the mid-40s to the late 70s. Excuse me. Most of them win nominal wage gains, which then get wiped out by inflation. At the same time, the union bureaucracy has, with the aid of the CP, consolidated its control over the industrial unions and wedded them to the Democratic Party. As the Democratic Party becomes the vanguard of U.S. imperialism's new antagonism with the Soviet bureaucracy, the CIO leadership is forced to choose sides in the Cold War. And it's over that issue, and not issues of workplace organizing, political radicalism, different visions of unionism, etc., despite what some historians and sociologists like Maurice Zeitlin and Judith Stepan Norris claim, this was the question that was at work in the purge of communists from the CIO. And the reality was, militant workers had little or no interest in defending the communists because they remembered the CP's wartime scabbing. It allowed forces like the Association of Catholic Trade Unionists, who were incredibly socially conservative and pro-U.S. imperialist, to appear to the left of the CP. To put simply, and I have to wrap up so we have some time for discussion, the mess we find ourselves in today, that despite the tremendous growth of socialism in the last 18 months, we are still mostly students and ex-students. Our connection to the organized or unorganized working class is at best micron thin. The historic isolation of socialism from the working class in the United States, the breaking of those ties that were real up and through the mid to late 1940s, has to be understood as the direct result of the Popular Front strategy. And I think what we need to do is study this period more so that when we're engaging in discussions with people who are coming into the socialist movement, especially those who want to do work in the workplace, who want to rebuild unions, etc., to explain why adapting some new form of this strategy will produce exactly the opposite results that they seek. They seek to make socialism again relevant to the American working class. These politics are the politics and strategy that resulted in our irrelevance. Thank you, comrades.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.